Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Omar Badar, and I'm here again with my friend and colleague, Diana Boutu. And today we're discussing the new Amnesty International report on Israeli apartheid and all the waves it's been making. The report details how unlawful killings, forcible transfer, large-scale theft of Palestinian land and property, and the denial of basic freedoms under Israeli rule are all components of a system which amounts to the crime against humanity of apartheid under international law. But it seems like what's making headlines isn't so much what's being said as who's saying it. Because, as you've said, Diana, Palestinians have long been saying that Israel practices apartheid, and this isn't the first time that we've seen documentation of Israeli apartheid.
You're absolutely right, Omar. This is not the first of its kind. And you can even think back as far back as more than two decades ago, where we saw reports by Palestinian human rights organizations such as Al-Haq, who came out during the Durban Anti-Racism Conference in South Africa in 2001 and declared it apartheid alongside South African anti-apartheid activists, including the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who said that this was even worse than the apartheid in South Africa. We saw even more recently, back in, I believe it was 2006, with Jimmy Carter and his book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And then others, including ESQA, which is the UN body that came out with their report. And then last year with Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, both coming out with their reports. So this is definitely not something new. I think what is different this time around is two things. First, we're talking about Amnesty International, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, human rights organizations around the world, with millions of members around the world. And to see Amnesty International come out with such a report is something that's definitely new. But the other piece of it that is new is that unlike the other international human rights organizations, such as Human Rights Watch, which came out and labeled apartheid inside the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, Amnesty International is also coming out clearly and making the connection between what Israel is doing in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip and the occupied territories, as well as in 48 Palestine. So that's really the only difference. The sad part of this, though, Omar, is that, as I mentioned earlier, is that Palestinians from across the political spectrum have been calling it apartheid for more than two decades, and they didn't make this differentiation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They talked about it all being apartheid. And so it's sad to me that it's taken two decades for international human rights organizations to catch up, but we'll take what we can get at this point.
Diana, I think many who've been around during the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa already understand the meaning and significance of international recognition of Israeli apartheid. But perhaps some younger listeners would want to hear a little more about what apartheid actually is.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Look, apartheid is an Afrikaans term, which actually means separation, separateness. But that's not the part that actually matters. The part that matters is that it's not the definition, it's the practice. And the aim of apartheid in South Africa, as in Israel, is to create a system of privilege in which one group of people is privileged at the expense of another group of people. So in the case of South Africa, it manifested itself in terms of voting rights, in terms of ownership, in terms of work, in terms of the system of basic rights and privileges. Now, in the case of Israel, it's a little bit different. This isn't just a question of voting rights, but it's a far more insidious, far deeper system of apartheid. It's a far deeper system of discrimination, segregation, and privileging that exists inside Israel. I'll give you some very basic examples so that people can understand how the system works. So one thing that the Israelis keep talking about is that Palestinians inside Israel have the right to vote. And yes, they do have the right to vote. But that isn't an indicator of the lack of apartheid. The indicator that there is apartheid is the system, the greater system that exists within the state of Israel. And here's some examples. For example, even if a person, a Palestinian, can vote or be elected to the Israeli Knesset, these same people cannot ever become the prime minister of the country. Why? Because one of the laws that's in place inside Israel makes it so that only those who believe in a Jewish state and in Jewish privileging can be a person who holds this position and in office.
And I know there have been countless efforts by Palestinian members of the Israeli Knesset or Israeli parliament to pass a bill simply declaring that Israel is a country of all of its citizens, essentially asking for equality among citizens. And the Israeli parliament finds the concept of equality so offensive and they're so hostile to it that it refuses to even give that bill a vote.
And again, this is not just the Israeli right wing that tries to crush these types of laws. It's including some of the so-called left wing, including Labor and others, who have come out very definitively and said that they don't want to see equality in the state because it breaks down the idea of a Jewish state and Jewish privilege. Now, I just want to tell you a quote by the former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he came out very clearly and he said, Israel is not a state of all of its citizens, but rather the nation state of the Jewish people and only them. So he's saying it very, very, very clearly about what it is that this state is based on and how who is entitled to rights and who is not entitled to rights.
And you can imagine how that fundamental rejection of equality manifests through all aspects of Israeli society.
But I want to give you an example when it comes to something simple as choosing where it is that you want to live. For Israel's Jewish citizens, they have the ability to live wherever they want inside historic Palestine. They can live in a settlement, even though it's illegal. They can live in any city, any town. They can purchase anywhere they wish. But when it comes to Palestinians, including Palestinian citizens of Israel, they don't actually have that right. Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are subjected to something called an admissions committee law. And what that means is that certain towns that are of a certain size, have the ability by law to discriminate and to selectively choose who it is that is able to buy within that town. Now, this should be sending alarm bells ringing in the minds of many people to say, wait, how is it that a town can decide who can live in it? But that's the way it works in Israel. And it's not just a law. It's been a law that's been upheld by Israel's highest court. And Israel's highest court has said, yes, of course, these towns have the ability to discriminate against people. It wouldn't make sense otherwise. So even something as basic as choosing where you want to live, Israel has a hierarchy of rights, with Israel's Jewish citizens having the highest privileges, and of course, Palestinians not having those privileges.
It's really quite something, the idea that a housing admissions committee can reject you because they deem you, quote, not culturally suitable to live in a Jewish neighborhood, which is not subtle at all. And it's fascinating thinking of this from a U.S. perspective, where we have anti-discrimination laws and equal opportunity provisions. And if you're caught discriminating on the basis of race or religion, you're in big trouble, legally speaking. And yet in Israel, the law explicitly protects the right to discriminate against Palestinians in things like housing.
But it gets even further than that. You can look at something as basic as who has the ability to live in the country. And I can speak to my own personal example. My father was born in Palestine, and his entire family was born in Palestine. They were raised in Palestine. They went to school in Palestine. And during the Nakba in 1948, my father and his entire family fled. And one of the people who fled was his older sister. Now, this was a woman who was born in Palestine. She was raised in Palestine. She got married in Palestine. She had her first child in Palestine. And during the Nakba in 1948, like hundreds of thousands of others, she fled and ended up in Jordan. Now, my aunt ended up passing away in a refugee camp in Jordan, unable to return to Palestine, even though she was born here, she was raised here, educated here, got married here, had her first child here. And even though her family was living in the city of Nazareth. So she remained apart from her family from 1948 until her death in the year 2002. Contrast that with any person who is Jewish. Any person who is Jewish from anywhere around the world, they don't even have to have a connection to this place, has the ability to come here and to acquire citizenship upon arrival. And so you can see just how different the system is, the treatment is, that my late father was unable to bring over his sister, who was born here, raised here, married here, had her first child here. And yet any person who is Jewish around the world can come and live here, no questions asked. And it's not just when it comes to citizens of Israel, but also, as you can see, from people who are from the West Bank, people who are from the Gaza Strip, they also don't have an automatic right to be able to live here. We've seen in the case just this past couple of weeks with Israel's killing of the Palestinian-American Omar Asad. He was somebody who was born also in Palestine before the creation of the State of Israel, and yet was also unable to live in the West Bank because Israel had taken away his ability to live here. Contrast that with anybody who is Jewish who can arrive at any point in time and be able to acquire citizenship upon arrival. So you can see how the system of privilege is created, where a certain class of people have rights and another class of people, the indigenous people, don't have these rights or have their rights stripped away from them. We see it even go even further, where things like the denial of freedom of movement is only for Palestinians. We don't see that Israelis are barred from traveling, that Israelis can't go from one area to another. That's only reserved for Palestinians. And we see that time and again that these home demolitions and forcible transfer, which is the forcible removal of Palestinians from their homes, is again only reserved for Palestinians. It's never something that Israel does against Israelis. And it's done for political purpose. All of these things are done for political purpose. And that's the essence of apartheid. It's maintaining not only a system of privilege, but it's done for political purpose. And this is why Amnesty and all these other organizations are coming out and labeling it as apartheid, because it is apartheid.
Diana, you mentioned a minute ago that when Netanyahu was still prime minister, he explicitly said that Israel is not a country of all of its citizens, but a country for its Jewish citizens and them alone. He's basically openly saying that Israel is an apartheid state. That's basically what he's saying. He's not using the word, but he's confessing to the substance of the apartheid charge. So I don't understand, why is there a meltdown by Israeli officials every time a human rights organization accuses them of something that they themselves keep saying openly?
That's a great question, Ahmad, and it's, I think you might be a little bit surprised by the answer. So there's a disconnect between the what the Israelis are saying outwardly, I mean, to a public internationally, and what they're saying internally. So I'll talk about external, and then I'll talk about internal. So externally, of course, they're condemning the report. They're saying that the world doesn't understand Israel, that, of course, they're using their usual talking points, which don't bear repeating at this point in time, which we've refuted time and again. And, of course, you see that the U.S. State Department has chimed in along with them and other countries as well, are really hesitant and loath to adopt these reports, even though they love adopting the reports of Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and others when it comes to other countries and so on. That's their external face, which is to smear Amnesty International, smear Human Rights Watch, to come out with all of their useless talking points and so on. That's the external face. Internally, it's actually a very different matter. Internally, this report barely got a yawn inside Israel. And the reason that it barely got a yawn is because, as you already said, Netanyahu's pretty much called it apartheid. And other Israeli prime ministers have used the apartheid label in the past as well, including Ehud Olmert and Ehud Barak, two former Israeli prime ministers who talked about apartheid. Now, what's interesting is that inside Israel, the apartheid word doesn't have the same smear that it does around the rest of the world. They look at it and they say, yeah, it's apartheid, and so what? And that's the part that I think is really important, is that the rest of the world understands that apartheid is bad. The rest of the world understands that there was a whole sanctions regime that was placed on apartheid South Africa. And the rest of the world understands that you can't have a system in which you call yourself a democracy on the one hand and enact racist laws that are designed to privilege one group on the other hand. It just doesn't work that way. And so I think the main takeaway now is that Israelis now need to feel what it means to be apartheid, because for them, this just means it's just another report, it's just another label, and they don't seem to care. I think the main takeaway now is, how is it that we make them care? And hence, this is why you see that external hysteria on the part of the Israeli government, but internally, it isn't getting so much as a yawn. And I think where our work now should be focused on is making sure that yawn gets translated into, this is what it means to be an apartheid state, that there is an entire sanctions regime that follows when you get labeled an apartheid regime. That's, I think, the real takeaway from this report, is that countries need to start focusing on that second half of the equation, not just the labeling, because Israelis don't care about it, but what that label entails and what it means to be held to account and how it is that Israel must be forced to end its apartheid.
Well, the reaction from pro-Israel forces in the U.S. to this report has been hysterical, and it's clearly because they can't argue with the substance, so they resort either to blindly claiming that the report is full of lies, without even attempting to provide evidence because they know there isn't any, or they resort to fear-mongering by claiming, as the ADL did, that this report could spark anti-Semitic attacks. I mean, that's just such a cynical and distasteful exploitation of anti-Semitism, which is a real and rising problem in America, by the way. And they do it in order to silence criticism or even acknowledgement of Israeli government policy. And it's not just harmful to the defenders of Palestinian human rights who are being smeared by this charge, but it's also harmful to the real fight against anti-Semitism, because the cynical misuse of the charge really waters it down. But what's been really disappointing here, I think, even though it's not at all surprising, is how the Biden administration just dismissed this report out of hand, even though, as you said, they cite Amnesty International reports all the time to criticize other countries. But once again, it seems that Israel always gets an exception from the U.S. and that it's above any human rights standards or any requirements of accountability. But this report also had a lot to say about the need for the world community to hold Israel accountable. Can you talk about what's possible on that front?
Okay, I think in terms of accountability, the important thing is that the groundwork has already been laid by our South African colleagues and comrades. They worked tirelessly from 1948 onward, 1948 being the start of both of the Nakba, but also of the beginning of the formalization of apartheid in South Africa. And so they worked really hard to do everything from push for an international convention that makes apartheid a crime. They worked really hard to then push, even within the International Criminal Court, to make apartheid a crime against humanity. Now, they didn't have to do that because for them, apartheid in South Africa ended in 1994, and the International Criminal Court only came into being 5 years later, in 1999. And yet, what they were so determined to do was to make sure that that this label of apartheid wasn't just something that was going to stick to South Africa, but they wanted to make it so that no country around the world would be able to have a similar system. They don't have to be identical, but a similar system. That was the work that they were pushing for and the work that they did. And so when it comes to pushing for accountability, there are already mechanisms in place. They laid a lot of the groundwork when it came to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which Palestinians picked up on as far back as the First Intifada, you know, more recently in 2005, but as far back as the First Intifada. And so now it's incumbent upon us to both continue and to redouble our efforts when it comes to BDS, but to also be pushing for these crimes of apartheid to be held to account. And that includes internationally, and it includes in other countries around the world. There was so much work that was done during the apartheid era around the world to condemn South Africa's apartheid. And now, and it's been going on since with Palestinian activists who've been pushing for this. But now it's time for these other countries to also be looking at Israel in that same light, and for us to be pushing for Israel to not only face boycotts, not only face divestment, not only face sanctions, but to be held criminally to account, just in the same way that we pushed this around the world during the era of South African apartheid. It's very vitally important. Now, I want to just say one more thing, Omar, about this whole framework, because I think I'd be doing a disservice if I didn't talk about what the Palestinian reaction has been. Because here, the reaction has been basically of three types. There's been one reaction, which is, this is great. This is amazing. Finally, we see these human rights organizations that are following upon the work that Palestinians have been talking about for all of this time. The second reaction has been one of, we have to be careful about just labeling this apartheid, because it isn't just apartheid. This is settler colonialism, which means that this isn't just a question of trying to break down discriminatory laws, but we should also be looking at what happened in 1948 and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and be trying to address that. And the third reaction has been, okay, great, so what? And I think that it's this so what reaction, that this is great, but so what, that the world needs to show that this isn't just a so what, that words actually do mean something, that systems mean something, that history means something, and that there is the ability to end this system of oppression, and that they actually mean business about ending this system of oppression. So for me, in watching all of this unfold and watching the Palestinian reaction, I really think that it's so incumbent upon the rest of the world now to no longer be hung up on what label is being used, but to actually start putting into place measures to finally hold Israel to account. And that's the part that has been missing for such a long time. You know, for 20 years, 20 plus years, the debate has been about what label to use. And I think that now we are at this point where it's enough for the West to be trying to figure out which label it is that they should be placing upon it. We all know that what Israel's doing is wrong. And now's the time for accountability.
And certainly accountability here in the U.S. is critical because it's precisely U.S. policy that gives Israel a sense of impunity to behave as it does, with unconditional military funding and unconditional diplomatic cover. And as you said, the time for debate and discussion on this is really over. I mean, it's time for real consequences, and the Biden administration here has a very simple choice to make. Either side with the human rights community by ending U.S. support for Israel's apartheid government, or just keep sticking your head in the sand and carry on with politics as usual in maintaining this really immoral foreign policy that history will not judge kindly. You know, to the extent that U.S. democracy still remains semi-functioning at this stage, I really think that all of us in the U.S. have an opportunity to demand a different policy from our government. Deanna, is there anything else we should talk about before we wrap up?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned this, Omar, because I want to take you back in time to during the South African apartheid era. The United States was the last country to fall. It continued to support apartheid in South Africa up until the very end, practically. And it was very telling that Nelson Mandela was only removed from the terrorist list in 2008. That's when apartheid fell in 1994. And he was elected president during that year as well. So, you know, it's quite amazing when you see just how wedded the United States has been to this concept of apartheid, whether it was in South Africa or in Israel. So none of these remarks really surprise me. It would surprise me if they had gone the other way and seen the light, given the United States' history and given how wedded it is to maintaining this apartheid regime. It's not just, as you put it, it's not just a passive bystander, it's an active participant in making sure that this apartheid regime not only survives, but thrives. And so it's not at all surprising that they came out condemning this report, putting their heads in the sand, just as they did when it came to apartheid in South Africa.
Well, we certainly have our work cut out for us in creating a meaningful change in the U.S. Deanna, it's always insightful speaking with you.
Thank you, Ahmad. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Butsu. Thanks for listening.